chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm excited to have Zach Clark on the show today. Zach is the founder and lead spokesman of Development and Leadership Coaching. Well, welcome everyone to the Something Extra podcast today. I'm so delighted to have my friend Zach Clark with us today. And Zach, I was thinking about it this morning. I was thinking, I always like to go back and say how I got connected. I feel like you and I have been connected forever.
It has been a long time. Yes.
It's been a long time, but I don't even remember now how we got connected. Do you?
Yes, I was serving as director of advancement at Westminster Christian Academy, and I think at least one, maybe two of your children attended there for a time.
Yes.
And I was very new in the role of director of advancement, and we had this big plan, this big vision ahead. So I knew I needed a lot of help and a lot of wisdom. And so somehow your name had come up and your husband, Greg, as well. And I reached out to you, I think, first. And you were just so gracious to meet and listen to what I was trying to tackle and gave me really good advice. And then got to meet Greg. And then I think from time to time for years, you've just continued to be willing to invest in me and answer hard questions and tackle big ideas with me, and I've learned so much from you all through the years. So I think that's how it started.
Yeah. Well, likewise, Zach, I feel like I always come out richer after spending time with you. And, you know, we've already collaborated on some things, and we got some fun things in the future, you know, that we're going to collaborate on. But why don't you take us back? Tell me a little bit about how you grew up. I know you were born in Knoxville, but tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I appreciate it when people ask about my childhood, because I definitely had a unique childhood, because my dad was from Knoxville. My mom was from Savannah, Georgia. But when I was 9 years old or so, they decided to move our family to a really small town in Arkansas, less than 100 people, Gregory, Arkansas. And, I was in Christian schools starting at kindergarten. My brothers were as well. But they decided to move. I think I was in fifth grade when they made that decision. And basically, they decided to move to Arkansas because of the duck hunting. You know, my dad was a big duck hunter. And I have two brothers that are younger, that are identical twins. And he wanted to be around some of the greatest duck hunting in the world. And so there was this little town that he was familiar with, and they decided to move. At the same time, my brothers had been diagnosed as dyslexic. And so in the time, this was early 80s, in terms of Christian schooling, there just really wasn't much available to students with learning differences and learning disabilities. So that was a very difficult and painful time, I think, for my parents. And so my dad said, well, what are we going to do about education. And in Arkansas, you couldn't, at the time, legally pay someone to homeschool your children. Homeschooling was only legal if one parent was the instructor. My dad was a consultant and traveled all the time, so he could live anywhere. So he just came up. He was kind of an innovative guy, and he said, okay, well, we'll just start our own school, and that way we can hire a teacher and have them trained and have them equipped to work with these brothers, my brothers. And I was kind of a student that would do fairly okay wherever, so I don't think they were too worried about me. So my mom and dad literally had built in our backyard in Gregory, Arkansas, a little one-room schoolhouse, little red schoolhouse, complete with bell tower. And that's where I started sixth grade and graduated. My brothers, their senior year, transferred to a Christian school in Little Rock and graduated with honors from there. And so to this day, I love to tell people I am the sole graduate of Black Swamp Christian Academy. So
it was
Black Swamp Christian Academy. We lived on Black Swamp Road, and the road dead ended literally into the Black Swamp, which is on the Cache River, and some of the most amazing duck hunting in the country right there. So I love to tell people we were really the original duck dynasty, because it was all about our Christian faith, and my dad worked with ministries and Christian organizations and Christian schools, and we had this little one-room Christian schoolhouse with an enrollment of 3, and we duck hunted, and we knew no one like that. So
that's amazing. That is such an amazing story. I love, love, love that story. Everything about it. You know, so do you think it's still there, Zach?
Oh, it's still there. Yeah, one of my brothers owns the home, and I think he's converted the schoolhouse to like a shop or something.
A he shed.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
A man cave.
Right. Yep. So it was an amazing childhood. It was much more like nowadays what you might see at a small classical school. You know, very rigorous. My dad worked with Christian schools all around the country, so he had access to a lot of experts and would bring them in. We had 2 different consultants that would come in and test us and test the teacher and do all these things. And my dad always said he wasn't going to put all this time and money into this and then have someone, you know, say that it wasn't legitimate. So there was this incredible track record. So it was very, I tell people the best picture of what the education was like for me, anyway, was if you've seen the movie The River Runs Through It, there's several scenes where one of the boys is having to write a paper, and his father is the educator. He's a reverend Presbyterian minister, and his dad, the reverend, keeps editing the writing down and making him do it again and making him do it again and making him do it again. And that was really how my education kind of looked, was that you were expected to bring your best and continue to develop what you were working on until it was sort of at your best. It didn't really operate like, okay, you're done, here's the grade, we move on. It was a really a special thing.
That's special because you don't always get there, right? It's like, okay, just turn the paper in. But I think that was a very important principle that your dad and this teacher or these teachers were instilling in you, Zach, is that continuous improvement and just bringing your best and, you know, not just cutting corners and not just hurry up and get it done. So I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah, it was pretty unique, well, for sure.
Yeah. So I know that you have a lot of interest. I know that. I knew that you love sportsmanship. You've got like some musical abilities and training. You went to Belmont in Nashville. You're obsessed with learning habits, and that's, you know, we're going to talk a lot about that and probably has informed a lot of what you're doing today. But I knew that you love the outdoor fitness, storytelling, these kind of things, but I didn't know where that came from. So it was the duck hunting.
That's right. Yeah, outdoors. And then I was a musician starting at a very young age. I played piano. And so both my parents were really passionate about reading and learning. And my dad, I still remember one of the things that he talked a lot about was how God didn't make any junk, and that God is very purposeful about how he's created us. And so that was very impactful to me at a pretty young age, watching people struggle with the ideas of dyslexia or autism and things like that. So much more now is known and understood. But at the time, that was just very misunderstood and odd. And so I really saw, you know, every day what was really possible in learning and thinking. And as I watched my brothers learn, and then, yeah, and then I had those opportunities too. So yeah, I had multiple music instructors at all times and was really blessed to get to go to college on music scholarships and academic scholarships as well. And so it's a big part of my life. So that, I don't play at all, hardly now, which people are always so upset, like I'm robbing the world of my music or something. I wasn't that good, believe me. But it did create a lot of habits of discipline and diligence and focus that I do feel like really shaped me, you know, for
absolutely
good.
Absolutely. Yeah. No doubt. I mean, you know, it just kind of reminds me, I remember because our kids, you know, all did some music and theater. And I just remember even in theater, you know, in drama and things like that, it was like great for memorization, you know, which those skills carry forward with, you know, other subjects, right, Zach? It all builds on each other. Yeah. But I was thinking about you, and I'm like, you are a true Renaissance man with all of those.
I hope so.
With all of those things. And you know, so I kind of did a little research on Renaissance, the Renaissance man. You know, it started in Italy, and is really based on the belief that a man's capacity for personal development is without limits.
Yes.
And so, and I was thinking about that through the lens of what you're doing today, you know, as a leadership coach and how you're helping people. And I was thinking, wow, isn't that amazing? I mean, you're helping people reach for the stars and be all that they, God created and purposed for them to be. And, I love that. So I know that when you were 20, you worked for the Clark Company, which tell me more about the Clark Company. I'm thinking it's probably your dad's consulting business, you know, is that what it was?
Yeah. My dad started his own business. He came out of a development background. And by development, I mean in the nonprofit sector, the work of raising money, growing, giving, moving organizations forward through financial support. So he came out of that background professionally and became very good at it very quickly. You know, started at a really small Christian boarding school in East Tennessee about the time I was born. And then my mom was really very committed to the family and being a full-time mom. And people still give her a hard time about how she would cook all the food herself and mash it into baby food and all of that. And, at least with me, I don't know about my brother. She may have given that up by the time they came around.
They may have gotten the Gerber jars.
That's right. Could be. But, he started his own business coming out of that to really try to help others. So it was very expensive, very, what I would call traditional consulting, working on capital campaigns and, strategic planning, executive selection. So he did that, quite well, started that, yeah, as I say, when I was just a baby. So cut to age 20, I was focused on music and had the opportunity to be looking at changing schools or the next kind of chapter. And he contracted cancer. So he had major surgeries, radiation treatment and all that. And he had just taken on quite a few new clients. He had hired another consultant to work with him. So it was a very small business, kind of boutique. And I said, well, I'll come help you for 6 months. And that 6 months turned into almost 10 years. So I really had the opportunity to see the business grow and to learn from him. His first battle with cancer became four battles with cancer over 10 years. And he died and went to be with the Lord at age 59. So very young, relatively speaking. So that was the Clark Company. I you know, we tripled. It was pretty amazing the way all that unfolded, and tripled the business within a very short time. And the vision was that I would kind of take that on and going forward. And I learned so many amazing things from my dad. To this day, people remember and say he was one of the smartest people they ever got to be around, one of the more impactful people they ever got to spend time with. But he also had a lot of flaws, and it was very hard for him, like many founders, to just really truly see the business go beyond him. And so unfortunately, he did not really finish his life well. And that's painful to talk about, but I learned so much good. And I also learned a lot of things about what it can look like for a business owner to kind of not finish their life well. So I heard this great line in that series. Did you watch that series? I can't remember what it's called, about Julia Child starting the her cooking show.
Like, there was a whole cooking show. Yes, yeah, and I think it was called. Was it not called Julia?
It probably was Julia.
Yeah,
it's a delightful kind of a comedy take on it.
Right,
this beautiful series, very very well done. But she has this great line when her dad passed away. She said on her show that I am who I am because of my dad and in spite of my dad. And I thought, man, that is so true of many of us, I think, when you think about your parents. So, but that was the Clark Company. So I tell people that it's kind of like investing in the stock market when you're really young. I started age 20. So what happens when you start that young, trying to understand what leaders do and how you attract resources and really significant giving to accomplish big, big vision and dreams. When you start that young and stick with it, you kind of outrun a lot of people. So it's been 26 years now in the what I call the fields of the Lord. So
in 26 years, my goodness, we're gonna unpack all of that. Okay.
Oh, that's gonna be a long time.
A long time. Well, okay, to this point, and then we'll take a quick break. But you know, in 2013, you created and launched Development and Leadership Coaching, and it's really kind of a, you know, and I believe that this is correct, Zach, but it's really kind of non-traditional because you primarily, or maybe solely, focus on coaching for nonprofits, right?
Yeah.
I mean, not really in the private. So you know, tell me a little bit about Development and Leadership Coaching. I know you do the one-to-one. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you do? One thing I will say to our listeners that really caught my attention, Zach, you have a money-back guarantee.
That's right.
So you are very confident in the process. You're very confident in, you know, to be able to offer a money back guarantee. But tell me a little bit more about that. Tell me what your sweet spot is, what primarily you guys are doing for these organizations.
Well, I shifted from the consulting world when I worked with my dad to become a director of advancement. So that would be the person who's really responsible for leading the efforts to raise money and communicate and move a ministry forward or a nonprofit forward. So I discovered, and I think it was day three on the job, that there's a big difference between being a consultant and being the person who's actually doing the work. Big, big difference. And I still have it in my journal, day three, what was going through my head at that time. So I learned so much, through that experience of building a team and seeing God really do impossible things through givers. And I began to really believe and experience the truth that God still is doing impossible things, but he often does that through people. And in the world or the point in history we are now, it takes massive resources often financially to really make a big impact. And that's, I think, a set of skills and disciplines that leaders can really learn and can grow and get good at. So we are very non-traditional in the sense that we don't really come at it and say, okay, we're coaches, so you have all the answers and we're just going to pull them out of you. We're just going to ask questions and ponder and be the sort of outsider expert. Instead, what we try to do is really know what's essential and what really, really you must do if you're going to move this from a vision or a dream to reality. And that it's not just that you must do it, but that you can, that it's not complicated. Mm-hmm. It's just really hard. It takes a lot of wisdom to really know what matters. And so that's what we really have tried to focus on. And a mutual friend of ours, I don't think I've ever told you this, Steve Dar, you know, yes. Steve Dar. Steve Dar was really instrumental in the questions and ideas that ultimately became development and leadership coaching, because he really could see this need that organizations have and leaders have to learn how to grow major giving, to really fulfill their plans and fund their plans and their vision. And I kept saying to him, Steve, I don't know why you think there's a need. There's consultants everywhere. I was one. I tell people now I'm a recovering consultant. And he kept pushing me, and others were as well, the same thing. And what we finally discovered was that the majority of nonprofits, and this is amazing, the majority of nonprofits in America, their total budget is less than $1 million. So that means like nearly 90%. So that means, kind of like your conversation with the leader at YWAM, that's a huge movement made up of all these little organizations. And so what that means is that it's very difficult for most of the people who are doing real life-changing work every day to access expertise like my dad. They would feel they can't afford it. And then if they did spend the money, and then they're kind of saying, did we even get anything for all that money? What did we have to show for it? So something kind of clicked, and that's what became development and leadership coaching, which was, what if instead of trying to do 1,000 things or come at it from a consultant expert perspective, instead we coach and guide might be a better word, and say, this week, this is what you do. And then next week, these are the three or four things you do. And the next week, and then we just walk with people week after week to see them grow giving. And then Steve Dar, among a couple others, was the one who said, if you really can nail down what's wise and essential and effective, why not guarantee the fee? And I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. It sounds like a sales gimmick. You're taking on all that risk. But what we've discovered is it creates a tension where a leader in an organization know they're investing in their capacity, trying to grow, trying to get better. And then we are equally invested. We've taken away all the budget risk. If what we tell them and challenge them isn't effective, then why in the world are we doing any of this? And God has really, really blessed that. Yeah. So here we are. We're in our 11th year. I think around 240 organizations have gone through coaching. We work with over 80 a month at this time. Yeah. Just a really
That's fun so thing. Cool, Zach. Yeah. So cool. Well, listen, I want to do a deeper dive. You know, I've got all kinds of things to talk to you about, you know, because you put some amazing content out there. I want to dig into that. You've got some ideas around hiring, and that really crosses both lines, nonprofit. So I want to dig into a lot more, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Zach Clark on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
So welcome back, everyone, to Something Extra Podcast with my good friend, Zach Clark. So Zach, here's the deal. You put out so much good content. And one piece of content that I read that you put out was switching from busy to effective. And instantly my ears perked up because I just know so many busy people. And I'm, you know, sometimes I really can fall into that trap too. But are you really being effective? And so, you know, the principles here in my mind apply whether it's nonprofit or for profit, really. So can you just kind of share the process that you take people through to help them move the needle from that busy to effective?
Well, I'm really honored that you would want to talk about this because I do notice that you're very busy, but highly effective people are busy. You know, I tell people all the time, you know, look for busy, get things done kind of people that you doubt would even get involved in helping you, because busy, get things done people get things done. They don't want to just, you know, goof around and not see something be fruitful and effective. So I think that anyone who's trying to be excellent and effective at what they do is going to struggle with this feeling of busyness or feeling stuck or feeling overwhelmed. I also think it's kind of like the water that we swim in right now. And so when you ask about process, I mean, the first thing I'm talking about a lot more lately is that there's a lot of things that we could share that you can do to become more effective instead of just staying stuck in this busy. But the first thing that's really hard for me to do, and maybe for you too, is we also just need to step out of the water sometimes. So instead of just flailing around in this culture that's, I'm so busy, I'm so overwhelmed, I'm so anxious, I'm so burnt out, that you can't work your way out of that. I tell people I have to work at resting. I can't just stop. That doesn't work for me. I have to work at resting. So I think that's a big part of it, is just decide to get out of the water in which we're all living in these days. But in terms of specific process, since you asked, I think that it starts with knowing what's really critically important for you as a leader that actually moves your organization forward. And so a lot of times people will tell you what their job is. They will tell you what their projects are. They'll tell you about all the things they've got going on. But if you say, what are you really, really responsible for? What are the things that ultimately someone is going to hold you accountable to as a leader, whether it's your customers or your board or your donors or your boss, if you have one? What are those things? And the reality is leaders don't typically have more than just a few, 3, 4, 5 things. And taking the time to really, really get those right. So for me, those are the vision, mission, values. You know, obviously, I'm sure that's that way for you. Financial health. I mean, if things get bad enough, I'm the one that's responsible. Shepherding people, self-leadership, thinking, planning. Those all sound easy to say, but I hate to say that it was really hard to get clear of those. So I have those written down along with just a few others, but it's usually a really short list. Once you've got that clear, you have to have a system, I think. You can't just say, well, I'm really trying not to be overwhelmed, trying to be less busy. If you are impactful, you're always going to have so much more that you could do, so much more that you wish you could do. And so having specific tools, one of the ones we talk about that Bill Hybels created is the 6x6, you know, identifying the 6 things in 6 weeks to work on.
So tell me a little bit more about that, because I had read that. What does that look like, Zach?
Yeah, it's quite simple. It's a thinking discipline, really. And it's the idea of thinking about, instead of just thinking about your life in terms of this year or this week, try to identify no more than 6 things that if you do them or influence them or push them forward, 6 things in 6 weeks, it actually moves the organization forward. So mm-hmm. a lot of times people are like, boy, I've really been dealing with a lot of email or a lot of this, a lot of that. Well, in 6 weeks time, is a lot of effort on that actually going to have moved the organization forward? You know, or I've been really working on our website lately. I've had to do that. Well, that really could move your organization forward, but you need to have thought that through. So it's a thinking discipline of clarifying what those are. And what I've noticed is even if you write those 6 things down, put a date on it, and then put it in a drawer and take it out 6 weeks, you will see it still affected your thinking. It still affected your actions. So a lot of times that busyness is you're reacting. So a tool like 6x6 is just a little simple system. I'm really big into budgeting your week, mm-hmm. or having what some people call a model week. So really deciding where Dave Ramsey says, you know, a budget is telling your money where to go before you have it. And I like that applied to time. Good. I'm going to mm-hmm. tell my time where to go before I have it. And then, the other thing, I guess the last thing I would just throw out there is that I've noticed this in trying to get meetings with people. So I started years ago, like you, I'd be like, I need to get a meeting with Lisa and Greg. How am I going to do this? They're busy people. What mm-hmm. I've found, and there's research to back this up, is everyone is overwhelmed for the next 2 weeks. Everyone, nobody has time. Everybody's busy. Everybody's overloaded. But mentally, they think beyond that, the workload drops off. So in that 6 week time frame, we feel much more free, which is ironic because 2 weeks from now, you're going to have another 2 weeks ahead of you, right? But
that's right.
Shifting out of that 2 week mentality to say, what am I doing in the next 2 weeks? What am I doing in the next 6 weeks? What am I doing in the next 6 months? So like my assistant who I've worked with, I think as long as you and Jenny have worked together, probably a decade or more.
Yeah.
She now just knows this about me that she'll say, is this a next 2 weeks thing, a next 6 weeks thing, a next 6 months? And so we're budgeting in those blocks. So those are just a few things.
Yeah, through a few things. Well, one thing that caught my eye, because we do the same thing with us, and it kind of goes into what we do as a business too, Zach, as you know, because we run, you know, technology. But, you know, one of the things you said is look at those things and say automate, delegate, or eliminate.
Ah.
But you got to take the time. You got to take the time to step out of the water.
Yes.
And kind of do a little bit of a assessment, right, of where your time is going. But I love that, you know, and, you know, you say that you make 3 lists and you say what can be automated, what can be delegated, mm-hmm. what can be eliminated. And just because we've been doing something over and over, it doesn't mean we need to continue to do something. Is it really bringing value?
Yes.
And ultimately, that's what we want to do is create value.
And what I found, Lisa, I don't know about you, I'd be very interested to know what you see, but what I found is really smart, energetic people on your team do not want to eliminate things. They're all for automating, using technology, they're all for delegating, but that thought process of stop doing this, once you get out of the annoying things, like they'll eliminate the annoying things. But the good things mm-hmm. to get to that level of, so I always look at like, is this hurting me? Like the other day I had to talk to you about something I'm mm-hmm. just going to have to say no to that I had originally said yes to. That was so painful. It's a really cutting to the pain. But if I'm not doing that, then I think I'm just running around saying I have priorities. But priorities means you have said no to so many things so that you can focus on the best things.
So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, we're still friends, Zach.
Thank you.
Even though you had to say no to me.
It's, I didn't say no to you. I just said
No to the timing, right?
See, now I'm
no
negotiating already. See, now I'm back to...
Yeah, that's right. Well here's, I want to move into this because I think this is so important too. And again, this goes across nonprofit and for-profits, but I know that you've always been fascinated with these leaders who have a knack for building high performing teams. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking about our mutual friend who's been a friend of yours for a long time. And then you introduced me, Mark Miller.
Yes, yes.
From Chick-fil-A, who's the VP of high performance leadership at Chick-fil-A. Gosh, I mean, and I think about, I don't know who said this, Zach, you probably do because you know so much about Chick-fil-A, but I don't know if it was Truett or who said it, but they said, we're not in the business of selling chicken as much as we're in the business of building people.
Yes.
I don't know if that was Truett. That was somebody though, Deanne or Truett or one of the Kathys, I think. But you know, you've got some great tips on hiring and
a
process.
As you said, I mean, I really tried to be a student and learn, and I've made some mistakes in hiring, like any leader has. I think that what I've learned is that great hiring starts with knowing that if someone doesn't work out, let's say you have to let someone go, that ultimately that's your fault because you're the one that hired them in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's really hard. Because we want to make it the other person. Oh, they didn't respond. They weren't a fit. Da, da, da. Well, still, you're the one who invited them in. You're the one who selected them. And so that to me, if that doesn't motivate you to get better at hiring, I'm not sure what will. Every now and then, when I found myself frustrated with a challenge phase, I'm like, who hired these people?
Oh, yeah.
The answer was always me. The answer was always me. So I learned so much from Mark Miller and others. When I found someone I could tell was just really doing this well. And the thing I guess I would say, there's so many things out there people could read or try. But here's the thing that I think about all the time is if this was an executive selection, if you're hiring someone to lead, you would probably not just post the position in an ad and choose the best candidates. Instead, you would probably quietly, maybe even years out, really be trying to identify amazing people and recruiting them over time. And so that's to me something I don't hear a lot about, which is by the time you need the position filled, that means you are in a position of really having to react to your situation. Mm-hmm. And so what I like to see people do and what I think even we try to do is get everyone involved all the time in identifying and cultivating potential team members and keep a list. So we have a list of people we're watching. And then over time, we might ask them to do something or take on a project. We might hire them for something. And so there's never, the more you can not have a position open, then the more free you I think feel to just build trust with people, watch them at work, ask them to volunteer, get involved on something with you as a volunteer. I mean, there's so many ways. I remember hearing Mark Miller say one time that he had developed a relationship with a guy for 15 years. Still trying to decide the right opportunity. And people will look at that and go, oh my gosh, I don't have time. Da, da, da. And I just go, gosh, they must be so much smarter than some of these people. Because and that's what I had to kind of face is I kept thinking my process, I'm smart. I'm going to be able to build a process that hires the right people. And it's so much easier when I have too many great people. I have so many great people, not enough positions. That's where you want to be. And I have found that no matter how large the organization, that can be done. And it frees your people to be thinking too all the time. Like, who do I know? Who do we need to connect with? Who should we keep an eye on? And it becomes fun instead of, oh my gosh, how do we fill this?
Right. Oh, I love that so much. You know, I mean, just real quickly, you know, just in case listeners are writing notes or writing in their journal, you say expand your inputs, give an assignment before the actual interview. And that can be in a volunteer type capacity, right? Sure. You already said that. Do the initial screening, personality assessments, you know, take advantage of those. You can learn a lot.
Yes.
Do more interviews. You said wear the candidate
out. Wear them out with interviews.
Which I think is so, so funny. But, you know, it's not like just one interview and then you hire the person. I mean, you have multiple interviews and see how they show up each time. Involve your team. And I was thinking about this when I told you our son Jordan is in Utah right now and he's kind of exploring the chef at Whole Foods. And, you know, after when they hire you at Whole Foods, after a month of being there, the whole team decides whether or not you stay.
Wow.
And I was like, well, that's kind of innovative, right? Because, I mean, again, then they've had a chance to work with you for a month. And, you know, if one bad apple, right, Zach?
Yes. Can, I don't want to know who you are. Bunch. Yeah, I don't want to know who you are in the interviews. You're amazing in interviews. I want to know who you're really, what you're really like to work with. And Mark, I remember here, this struck me. I mean, years ago, Mark told me about taking someone through all these interviews at Chick-fil-A, and he went through, I mean, this went on for a long, long time. And the guy got to, they were like, this is the guy, we're going to hire this guy. They were all on the same page. And then he got into an interview and completely lost it and just completely lost his temper. And said, I have had so many interviews. I've had to answer the same questions over and over and over again. This is completely driving me nuts. I just want to know if I got this, you know, freaking job. I mean, just completely lost it. Yes. And they're like, thank you very much.
thank you very much. But no, you did not.
Yeah. Now we know who, now we know what you're really like to deal with. So that really struck me.
Yeah.
And when you, and now what I would say about everything you just shared, by the way, thank you for quoting me like that. That's an honor. But everything you just shared becomes almost impossible when you're under pressure to hire. So that's the thing is that this is this ongoing lifestyle, not something that we do when we have to.
Yes, yes, for sure. Well, okay, so I've got a few more things here and then we'll talk about something extra. But you know, this is really moving into nonprofit, and I know every nonprofit out there, you know, it's you got to have funds, right? And you've got to have donors. It's a group effort, right, Zach? It takes many people to pull those things off. But you know, I want to talk about the attraction, care, and feeding of donors. And you have so much wisdom on this subject. And I read something that you had written, and you said, you know, I can describe it in two words. The two words were follow up, you know, and follow up and close the loop on things. But, you know, what would you have to say about that for any nonprofits that might be listening?
Yes. I mean, follow up is where all the results are and what most organizations do really poorly, whether it's a business or a nonprofit organization. So what we have seen, and there's a lot of leading donor-centered research that really backs this up, is that givers in America at this point in time, this point in history, are really actually being treated very, very poorly, being treated like checkbooks, being treated as if they could be manipulated through data and communication and marketing. And, you know, to an extent, people can be manipulated, whether it's buying a product or giving. But the long-term cost of that is probably impossible to really calculate. So what I really believe is that God is who he says he is. And he says he has all the resources. He says everything on earth and heaven is mine. So when we feel like we have these resource problems, what we really have are people problems, because people are the part of God's creation that he uses to actually get things done. And so we have to really be thinking about how we lead and care for and steward and build trust among people. And when you do that, giving people will give. That's what they do. Non-giving people won't give. That's what non-people giving people do. right. So givers really bring, I think, more and more an investment mentality. What is really being done with the money? There's a lot of trust issues, as you can see, all across our society. And so for leaders, that means really being committed to growing a healthy community of givers face to face and bringing people together in small groups. And yes, doing the big events or communicating, but doing that in a very trust building way. Saying thank you, actually telling people what you did with the money, kind of a novel concept. Yes. Asking mm-hmm. them to do things that are meaningful, and then following up because it's important. I didn't just ask you to try to manipulate you or get something. I asked you because it's important. This is really mm-hmm. important. Did you take time to think about it? Even if the answer is no. And that's where the follow-up is. So those are just a few things. This is not a money problem. We live at a point in time in history where money is not the issue. That no one can look around and go, boy, our society has a lot of money problems. Now, we've got a lot mm-hmm. of people problems. And to me, that's discouraging. Yet the hopefulness is that that means a leader can do something. Because leaders know how to work with people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's just a great perspective. Well, okay, so I'm going to do some rapid fires here, and then I'm going to ask you about something extra. No, these are just, you know, I've got a good friend. I'm going to shout out to my good friend, Dan Roberts. I always will give him credit for this, but he always says every person has isms, you know. There's Jenny isms, there's Lisa isms. So here's some Zach isms. And, you know, I'm just going to say these real quick. And if you've
really
got
scared.
One little thing to say.
No. So you want me to explain it or something? Is that what you're saying?
Well, if you have anything to add, feel free to do that. But here's what you said. Recording personal reflections allows you to recognize where you have come from, which will help you and inform you of how and where you're to go from there. Hmm.
I would just say that's a big part of learning is taking the time to reflect on what is it that I say is important? What is it that I say I believe? What is it that I say that I won't do again? And how do I make sure that I take what's good forward? And how do I maybe leave behind what needs to be left behind? And the only way I really know how to do that is by writing that down and looking at it every day if I'm taking it forward, and writing it down so I can forget about it if I need to let it go.
Exactly. Yeah. Writing it down. If you want to leave it behind, write it down, then light a match. Yep. Maybe. Yep. Okay. Here's another one. The higher your degree of ownership, the higher your standards.
Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, I think one of the greatest lies that we believe is that you get what you pay for. And no, the greatest things that you get, you didn't pay for. So there's something higher than just doing a good job because you're paid for it or someone's placed value on it. All the research points to this, that beyond a certain point economically, financially, once people feel predictable, have their life as predictable and stable, beyond that, more money doesn't seem to actually help or affect anything meaningful. And so, yes, ownership or stewardship is another good word for that. The more you view yourself as having ownership of this, or this is something I've been entrusted with for a time, that's where the creativity comes. That's where you're bringing your best. That's where you're doing things that no one else would do. Mm-hmm. And so I think about that a lot, that are we, by putting a number on everything or price on everything, are we actually losing sight of what inspires people to do better? Most people who founded things, like my dad, are smart so they can see a financial benefit, but that's not really what was driving them. And then you know this, like working with team members like you do, there are some people that there's just no explanation for why they are willing to do what they do at the level they do. It can't be bought, right?
Yeah.
To me, that's ownership.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've got a recent example of that. This person, boy, just always above and beyond in the ownership that she took in her job. I'm giving a shout out to Morgan Cochran, and today's her last day. Yay, Morgan. And, you know, she's been with us now for 5 years and has just been an invaluable team member, but has kind of done some self-reflection, and she's going to get her doctor of chiropractic. So she's starting at Logan. Yeah. So I told her I can't wait to get that, those discounted chiropractic services one day. But yeah, that totally resonates with me. Well, let me just give you a couple more here and then we'll talk about something extra. Oh gosh. And I believe in this one. Annual reinvention is a must.
Yeah, I don't. You're saying what? I guess I could add to all of these, but yeah,
I think both from an organizational. Yeah, I think both from an organizational as well as a personal. Yes.
So you think about the amount of change that our world has experienced just in the past few years, and then if you put that in the context of a growing organization, the organization could outgrow me, and that would mean I'm not going to be very helpful. Or unfortunately, sometimes people outgrow organizations as well. Mm-hmm. But I think it's critical to, we only get the same amount of time that everyone else does. And so again, that idea is, what is it that I have to change in me that really tells me deep down I am growing? I am growing in wisdom. I am growing in insight. I am growing in skill. Otherwise, I don't know there's a lot of value in getting older if you aren't. So,
that's true.
You have to reinvent every year.
I'm having to like narrow this down because I know we're out of time, but I'm going to steal this one from you. Okay, Zach, just let you know, be a learn it all, not a know it all.
Yes.
And I love that, you know, that totally resonates with me. And then the last one, I guess I'll point out is, and I love this too, leadership is a verb. Leadership is a verb. And the question that you ask is, who are you pouring into? So good stuff, my friend. I could just keep going.
It does sound awfully, it does sound awfully wise when you say it. That's for sure.
Well, this is something extra. Zach, what do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
I would say self-leadership. Self-leadership. Most people who are leaders think most of the time about leading the people that they somehow believe they're responsible for or holding accountable or directing or hiring. And that's, to me, that's normal everyday thinking. But that leads to normal everyday organizations with normal everyday results. So instead, I think the way to see something impossible happen is to focus on leading yourself well first, then those you're accountable to, those above you, whether that's your Heavenly Father, your board, your customers, then your peers. And if you think about that, if I'm spending a lot of time leading myself and a lot of time leading up and a lot of time leading my peers, then I'm not going to have a whole lot of time to manage those that are, quote, below me. And Jesus, I think, was the most perfect example of this, because you can see he was so intentional about his use of time and his focus and resting and time with his Father. He also was really intentional about managing his relationship with his Father. He was really intentional about managing relationships with the 12. And then what about everyone else? He talked about just serving them. He didn't talk about lording over them. And so that to me is that something extra, leading yourself well, self-leadership.
I love it. Well, Zach, thank you so much. I know how busy you are and how effective you are. Not just busy,
so
but effective too.
You're so kind.
And I appreciate you making the time to be on the show today.
Thank you.
This was just kind of fun.
It's an honor. Thank you. Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.